This morning, he's going to talk to us on the topic, the pastor as a counselor. Dr. Harn.
There are some more of these sheets at the door if you'd like to pick one up. If you slip by without picking one up. Thank you, Dr. Klotz, for that very brief introduction. I assume that my name is virtually a household name by now. As you note, I forgot to wear my name tag. I don't know if this is a Freudian slip or whether it is manifest my confidence that indeed that is the case. Well, as a matter of fact, I know that this is the case. This is partly a commercial. When I went over to the Concordia Historical Institute a couple of weeks ago to join, and I hope each one of you, while you're on the campus, if you haven't joined, that you'll go over and join. It's a very, very important and a very vital part of the ministry of our church. When I went over there, I plunked down my $5 and took a copy of the quarterly, and the lady said, "Oh, I know you. You're new around here, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And she filled out my receipt, and "Here you are," she said, and I looked at it and said, "Dr. Oliver Harn." So, my name is a household name around here.
Singular, not plural.
That's right. So, interestingly, I have a twin brother, so we should be plural, but, well, what can you say? yesterday, Dr. Charlemagne also said that if you write, let's see, what's that expression again? He who writes, how's that?
Writing
makes an exact man. Well, I have quite a bit of writing here. I hope it'll be a manifestation of my exactitude. The subject at hand, of course, is the pastor as counselor. It almost seems incredible these days that anyone would suggest that one could pit counseling against preaching as being vital to effective ministry. And still you find the fellows talking in the halls, well, saying something like this, "Well, I focus mainly on preaching. I don't care too much about counseling, and really it isn't that important to my ministry." I suppose if you were talking about mediocrity in one's ministry, one would certainly agree that the church can get by without one being an effective preacher and without one being an effective counselor. Somehow, the churches seem to bear eloquent proof to the fact that it is by the grace of God that the church proceeds. Sometimes, as I think about that, and as I think about my ineptitude in preaching and also in counseling, I realize that that indeed has been the case in my ministry. What we have in mind today is effective ministry. And obviously, both preaching and counseling are vital in this kind of ministry. In reality, whether a person likes it or not, he is going to engage in counseling. Wayne Oates put it this way. He said, it's not a matter of choice. The only choice one has is whether one will be effective or ineffective in counseling. Personally, I would opt for effectiveness if I would attempt to avoid mediocrity. I'm sure this is true of you all. Regardless of what our bent is, we must engage in pastoral counseling, and sometimes I suppose we can't even dignify what we do by the term pastoral, but at least I suppose it is counseling, or at least managing people or pushing them around or shouting orders, but it should be pastoral counseling for an effective ministry. All right, first of all, Then what is pastoral counseling? It would seem as though that would be an easy thing to define. As a matter of fact, it's like most things. When someone asks you the definition, as President Bowman did a couple of months ago with me, I have my degree in Christian education. He asked, how would you define Christian education? I'm still trying to find a proper definition for him. Maybe one of these days I'll come up with it. Same thing is true with regard to pastoral counseling. There is absolutely no agreement on a definition. As a matter of fact, one of the books that I read just recently by Gary Collins doesn't even mention a definition of pastoral counseling. It just assumes that we all know what it is. We could begin once again by touching on Wayne Oates when he says that counseling is ordinarily a non-medical discipline. Not that physicians aren't engaged in counseling, for indeed they are, especially in the light of the fact that estimates run from something like 25% all the way up to Helen Flanders Dunbar saying that 100% of all of the illnesses are fundamentally psychosomatic as far as their root is concerned. So physicians are counseling. But it's not fundamentally a task of dispensing medicine. It's not at all, as you know, although one almost feels as though he's been through major surgery when he gets out of a counseling situation, is not at all a surgical procedure as well. Rather, it deals with talking over a problem with the aim of modification of life's patterns that have become a source of difficulty. And this on the basis of personal involvement with one whose personal adjustment, whose lifestyle, whose wisdom makes him a desirable source of guidance for that desirable change, or that desired change. The task of the counselor is, according to the French proverb, to heal sometimes, to remedy often, and to comfort always. Now, obviously, many professionals and others are engaged in that kind of counseling. Guidance counselors, physicians, psychologists, psychiatrists, lawyers, teachers, social workers, and the like are engaged in that kind of counseling. However, when we add pastoral to it, then our definitions become somewhat muddied and somewhat difficult to grasp. For pastoral counseling adds a dimension to the process which alone earns it the appellation pastoral. And this is not at all to imply that it's an entirely different species, as it were, that it doesn't demand the same kind of expertise and reference to our understanding of man and the means by which he may be aided to free himself from the difficulties which are binding him at the moment. At its best, it does demand that, and more. But the fundamental quality which distinguishes it from other counseling is this, that it takes seriously man's relationship to God and the need for involving God in the total context of the counseling situation. Now, it's true that psychologists like Gary Collins and like Don Tweedy and Paul Tournier and others might indeed introduce the divine element in this situation. And I feel that in all likelihood one could say that they are engaged in pastoral counseling, though they are not themselves pastors. That's not the point here and now. They may be involved in pastoral counseling. What I'd like to involve us in today is our concern for that which is pastoral in terms of our own ministry. Now, Daniel Day Williams puts it this way, and I quote, God becomes the third person in the relationship. Or as Wayne Oates continues, instead of being simply a dialogue, a trialogue comes into being. If it is true that all pastoral counseling in some way draws upon the resources and employs some of the characteristics of a teaching process, and I think it certainly does, even in a fundamentally Rogerian approach. Then the words of the formula of Concord, the solid declaration, are applicable. Unless God himself is our teacher, it says, we cannot study and learn anything pleasing to him and beneficial to us and to others. If the Holy Spirit is indeed the Paraclete, if Jesus Christ is indeed the one of whom Isaiah spoke so many years ago, his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, then indeed pastoral counseling has resources and a source of strength which are beyond that of any other counseling profession. Newbell puts it very well when he writes, in the counseling process, a pastor should realize that it is always a matter of the parishioner and Christ, not of the parishioner and the pastor. What brings the parishioner and Christ together is not the pastor, but the Spirit. It is the Spirit's work, not the pastor's. That realization will keep him from personal, officious interfering, and also from personal anxiety. It will make him respect the integrity and value of the soul in its dealing with God. It will keep the pastor from coercion, moralizing, rationalizing, and philosophizing. It will take all the pride out of his heart. I wish that was so, but anyway, that's what he said. It will take all the pride out of his heart and also his fear. I'm still quoting him. It will make him content to listen and understand and to let the word do its work in season. It will do that, I'm sure, if we are continually aware of the fact that Christ is involved in this fantastically important, vital process. Such an approach would not be content with the definition of counseling, pastoral counseling, given by Paul E. Johnson in, The Psychology of Pastoral Care, when he writes, what then is counseling? Counseling is a responsive relationship arising from expressed need to work through difficulties by means of emotional understanding and growing responsibility. Not a word of God there. Better, really, is the definition of John Sutherland Bunnell in his Psychology for Pastor and People, written many, many years ago, as you may recall, back in the late 30s. He says, the goal of spiritual counseling is to bring men and women into right relationship with God and to lead them into the abundant life. Much better. The suggested definition, which I give you in your sheet, adapted from Kleinbell, I believe includes more of those things, more of those factors which a Lutheran would be concerned about. This is really just a working definition. It's a suggested definition. It may need some revision in your thinking. That's perfectly okay. At this point in my thinking satisfies me. Pastoral counseling is the utilization by a minister or other Christian, I include that for Gary Collins and some of the others, and for your wives who are doing a lot more pastoral counseling than a lot of people give them credit for. Pastoral counseling is the utilization by the minister or other Christian of a one-to-one or small group relationship to help people handle their problems of living more adequately and grow toward fulfilling their potentialities. This is achieved by helping them reduce the inner blocks which prevent them from relating in need-satisfying ways to God and others. The process involves the impact of the minister's Christian personality in life, the Word of God, and the insights of counseling technique so that God may draw the counselee to himself and lead him to the more abundant life. Now, as we proceed, I think if you are awake by that time, that you will see the unfolding of the rationale for the inclusion of the various facets of this definition into it as a whole. Now, just for a few moments, I'd like to talk about the history of pastoral counseling. Obviously, we're not going to touch on it all. I'm just going to pick out a few major points, or maybe you might think that I'm not picking out the major ones. It doesn't make any difference. But those that I consider to be of some importance, to indicate that we're not alone in this. Some people, you think, would imagine, believe that pastoral counseling is totally a phenomenon of the 20th century. And this, to me, is a very, very narrow view indeed. Of course, there have been tremendous strides in the 20th century. But the pastor's ministry is Seelsorge, is something that's been going on throughout the century, certainly to the beginning of the church. And a good case could be made, as Charles F. Kemp, in his delightful book, which sometimes lets you down, but which reads so delightfully, which he calls The Physicians of the Soul, states that it goes back not only to through the Old Testament, but touches virtually every group in history. He states categorically, as a matter of fact, and I quote, "There has apparently never been a time or a place when men did not seek out their religious leaders for personal help, advice, guidance, counsel, assurance, forgiveness, comfort, or help." And he touches upon the primitive tribes, their medicine men and the like, the Babylonian practice with which you may be familiar of private and public penance, the Brahmin codes of the Indo-European societies with their directors of conscience through the age of the patriarchs, the prophets, the rabbis, right through the intertestamental period to the time of Christ. And of course, as we look at our Lord Jesus, we realize that here is the counselor par excellence. We read with amazement, I'm sure, each time we read it, the story of his counseling with Nicodemus, the profundity of that conversation with the woman by the well, the depths of understanding and compassion as he deals with the woman who is taken in adultery, just to mention a few of them. And following in our Lord's steps is indeed St. Paul, who was himself a psychologist, as he speaks introspectively of his own life, and he writes to the church at Rome very interesting, probing words. "I do not understand my actions, for I do not do what I want, but the very thing I hate. Wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ my Lord." He struggles with his own ambivalence and ultimately comes to the conclusion that it's in Jesus Christ that the resolution can be found. And so he writes, and so much of his correspondence, guided and directed by the Holy Spirit, who is indeed the Paraclete, is a kind of verbal pastoral counseling. Incidentally, one can do an awful lot of pastoral counseling in preaching. One can do an awful lot of it, as Luther did, and we'll refer to this later on, through one's correspondence. Certainly, St. Paul did. He writes to his friends at Philippi. He says that the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall mount guard like a sentinel about their hearts and their minds, guarding it, see, keeping it in Christ Jesus. He tells them that they ought to focus on love, that there is an eternal quality about love, and the need for fulfilling their own destiny comes as they fill their minds with thoughts which are true and which are honorable, which are just, which are pure and lovely. Here is a key of growth and inner peace, he writes, and we could touch on so many other things. And one moves through the early history of the church, and one reads the Confessions of St. Augustine. And what a magnificent psychological study that is. We read of the work of Ambrose of Milan, of Basil, the Venerable Bede, St. Francis of Assisi, and others. We come to the time of the Reformation, and once again, of the man who stands out above all men, the man for all seasons indeed, is Martin Luther. A very interesting book was written at the end of the last century, which I just discovered the other day in our library here. It's a book by a German scholar, August Niebuhr. He entitles it Luther as Spiritual Advisor. It's interesting, I took the book out, Dr. Klotz, and it has in it the Pritzlaff Memorial Library. So far as I can determine, it has never been taken out. Written back in 1897. Well, anyway, it has been taken out once, anyway. I hope it'll be required reading for courses around here. I'm sure it's out of print, but unfortunately. But what he says, this is what he says. Luther, he says, never lost sight of the individual soul, for no trouble seemed to him so trifling, so no sorrow so insignificant as to be unworthy of his ministry of comfort. If you read the Tishrei, table talk, you'll find some magnificent examples of Luther's concern for people, his concern for their personal needs. And I found one that Niebuhr refers to, in which Luther is told that one of his friends has been taken rather seriously ill. And this is his response. That, he says, is a result of sorrow, which is often a cause of such disorders. For when the heart is troubled and sorrowful, then follows also weakness of the body. The diseases of the heart are the real diseases, such as sorrow, temptation, etc. Then he says, I am a real Lazarus, thoroughly tried by sickness. How typically Lutheran and almost spoken like a modern psychologist, which one is not at all surprised to find in a genius of Luther's magnitude. I found another book in the library which happily was taken out and much more recent. It's by Theodore G. Tappert. That is edited by Theodore G. Tappert. In the Library of Christian Classics, entitled Luther, Letters of Spiritual Counsel, and I'd certainly like to I didn't include that in my brief bibliography for some reason, but I'd like to commend that to you. If I've gone over too quickly and you'd like to get it afterward, I'll give it to you later on, or give it to you in our discussion later. But turning reluctantly from Luther, we hop, skip, and jump over the rest of the history of the church to the 20th century. We touch only on Richard Baxter of Kidderminster in England, the man who wrote the famous classic, The Reformed Pastor, a man who determined every year of his ministry, in spite of the fact that from the time of his 21st year, he could say that he did not know a single day without pain. He determined, and remember, he's the one who said, I preach as a dying man to dying men. He determined in a parish with 800 families to spend at least 1 hour with each family every year in counseling, spiritual counseling. He accomplished it. And they say that when he went to Kidderminster, it was like going to St. Paul going to Corinth, or like our being assigned in our first call to Moscow. But when he left, there was scarcely a family that did not know Jesus Christ. A lot of things we lament in the Reformed Pastor, but there's a lot there that the pastoral counselor could learn from. One of my particular favorites in the 18th century, or the 16th century, is George Herbert too, but we've got to skip over so many, but the 18th century would be Henry Drummond, whom you probably all know as the author of that little booklet, The Greatest Thing in the World. I don't know if you realize, however, that that booklet was an address that he gave to young men. And he is noted for his counseling ability with young men, particularly of college and professional school age. Henry Drummond, read his biography by George Adam Smith. If it doesn't move you, I'll be very, very surprised. Or think of the great Phillips Brooks, whose greatness was somewhat tarnished by the fact that I wrote my doctoral dissertation on him. Phillips Brooks, certainly the greatest preacher that the Protestant Episcopal Church ever turned out, for they're really not noted for much beyond their liturgical points of view. But Phillips Brooks was of the evangelical school, though he strayed considerably from that later on. But Brooks was a great pastor and is well known among his contemporaries for his very effective counseling. Interesting that some people in the 20th century feel that reflective listening is such a modern technique, while men like Brooks were using it for many, many years and with great effectiveness. And so we come into the 20th century. We find Anton Boysen, whom many people, including Newbel and a great number of writers, feel Anton Boysen is, in a sense, the founder of the modern pastoral psychology movement. Boysen, who himself went through was victorious over a period of insanity, and who wrote that fantastically searching book, The Exploration of the Inner World, something everyone, I think, should read. This man has this to say. He insists that the religious element within the context of counseling, I quote him, must not merely be accepted, but eagerly furthered. With that, men who were pastors and also counselors began to realize that they should not simply be counselors, but be pastoral counselors. There's considerable difference between the two, you know. Now, in the 20s, to go back to our history, the clinical pastoral education movement began. Many thousands of pastors have taken this type of education. In the 40s, the seminaries began to awaken to their responsibilities, and most of them offered an elective course, which two-thirds of the fellows skipped because it might have been taught by old sourpuss, the professor whom they didn't particularly appreciate. But now, fortunately, it has grown to a respectable position in most theological seminaries. And of course, in our seminary, which is indeed preeminent among all, we offer an SDM program which leads to certification by the American Association of Pastoral Counselors. It is a good program, and it is going to be a lot better as time goes on. Indeed, it's not at all unusual to find an organization such as we have here in the St. Louis area called the Pastoral Counseling Institute, which has some 8 clinically trained pastoral counselors on its staff. They work under the supervision, under the guidance of some psychiatric consultants, I understand, but they are doing a very effective work, I understand, also. Indeed, pastoral counseling has a long history, and it has come a long way. One of the questions that immediately arises then is, why is pastoral counseling so important today? To answer this, we raise several other questions. The first is, to whom do people turn when they need help? I don't know if you're familiar as I choke to death up here, maybe you can think whether you've ever encountered that rather intriguing study which was conducted back in the early 60s, I think it was 1960s, as a matter of fact, by University of Michigan, which they consulted a great number of people in the United States to determine, first of all, their personal evaluation of their mental health, and then to whom they turned when they felt that they needed some help. The results were quite interesting. 42% of them had gone to clergymen, 29% to non-psychiatric physicians, 31% had turned for help to psychiatrists, psychologists, or marriage counselors. We can't avoid the fact that people are turning to us more than to psychiatrists and psychologists when they need help. Dr. David Chamberlain, with whom I studied some years ago in the area of pastoral counseling, told one of our classes that of the people who turned to who needed counseling, 65% of those who turned to clergymen said that they felt that they were assisted, they were aided. 65% of those who went to non-psychiatric physicians said that they were helped. And only 45% who went to see the psychiatrist and psychologist said, yes, we were helped. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of reasons for that. Maybe we don't see as seriously disturbed people as the psychologists and psychiatrists, and there may be a lot of other reasons for it. Nonetheless, that is the evaluation of the people themselves. They do turn to us, and they turn to us in great numbers. Secondly, what is the magnitude of the mental health problem in the United States today? It's a fact which is indisputable that untold numbers of people suffer each year from what psychologists call mental illness or emotional disturbance. At this very moment as we sit here, there are more people being treated for emotional illness or disturbance than any other illness. According to the National Clearinghouse for Mental Health Information, the chances of having a serious emotional breakdown are 1 in 10. Their figures as of 1970 indicate that every year 2,500,000 people have a serious emotional collapse. The present estimate of the cost of emotional illness, and you may, I'm using that because that's the term that psychologists use, we may question whether we will use it at all when we get finished with the paper today. But the cost is estimated at upwards of $20 billion annually. No one can begin to estimate the cost in terms of human suffering. I like to think of abnormal or atypical behavior from a pastoral point of view as loss of potential, loss of human potential. Think of what it is in terms of the loss of human potential. They tell me, this clearinghouse, that of the children born in 1960, and that's just, could have picked any year, but 1960, expect 2% at least to suffer at some time in their lives with schizophrenia, the most difficult of the psychoses to deal with. Depression is the number one malady of our times in terms of magnitude. It results in more than 100,000 hospitalizations a year. It's estimated that suffering from depression results in four-fifths of the suicides. Of the 25,000 suicides a year, 20,000 of them are attributed in one way or another to depression. This means that during our brief lecture of today, please come, you know, pick a chair. We just love to have you, ladies and gentlemen, just love to have you. This means that during the course of our brief, or maybe you think it's going to be interminable lecture today, four or five people will take their lives. Four or five people will take their lives in the course of an hour and a half. Every 20 minutes or so, someone succeeds in committing suicide. Something like 12 to 15 will try, and for one reason or another, not succeed during this hour and a half as we sit here comfortably or uncomfortably on your... That's, you know, one of the reasons that they make these chairs hard are the lectures that we give, that I give here. They just got some new chairs that brought them in on March 1st. Why is that? I think there's an coincidence. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that in addition to the 100,000 persons hospitalized for depression each year, there are between 4 and 8 million who are in need of some help. So you can readily see why the Wall Street Journal, that great medical journal, refers to depression as the disease of the 70s, or as the common cold of psychotherapy. A study by the University of Michigan referred to before indicates that the extent of the disturbances revealed by the respondents was impressive indeed. Less than 5 out of 10 Americans considered their marriages very happy. Among those who felt themselves happily married, over half considered themselves inadequate as husbands or wives. Almost 25%, 1 in 4, admitted that they feared that they were at one time or another at the point of a nervous breakdown. Add to these statistics the problems of drugs, the twin epidemics of venereal disease and alcoholism which is reaching unbelievable proportions today, the shocking crime rate, we begin to see something of the magnitude of the problems of emotional nature facing the country in which we live today. To suggest or to imply that the answer lies solely with more effective pastoral counseling is, of course, absurd. However, some of these people, and great numbers of them, will seek out a clergyman for help. To be the best possible counselor is indeed a legitimate goal for any of us, for all of us to pursue. Now, what's the magnitude of the spiritual problem of the day? Well, you know that as well as I do. But some people, Jay Adams and others included, would castigate me for suggesting that there should be a disjuncture between spiritual problems and emotional problems. As a teaching psychologist, I guess I just feel somewhat reluctant to go quite that far. But this, indeed, one cannot for a moment discount. And that is that at its root, every problem is in some way or another a spiritual problem. It has as its root, as the philosophers and the psychologists have been telling us for years, it has at least partly the root of what we call existential anxiety. Forgive me for quoting from Paul Tillich in his Theology of Pastoral Care when he writes, "Anxiety is the awareness of finitude. Man always lives in the consciousness or the unconscious anxiety of having to die. Non-being," he continues, "is present in every moment of his being. The vicissitudes of existence threaten him from all sides. Suffering, accidents, disease, loss of relations to nature and man, loneliness, insecurity, weakness, and error are always with him. Finally, the threat of having to die will become the reality of death. All this he must bear, and all this he can bear only in the power of that in which non-being is eternally conquered, the power of the divine. It is a function of pastoral care to communicate this power and to mediate the courage to accept finitude. Howard Kleindel, in what has to be, if you don't have his book, Basic Types of Pastoral Counseling, it has to be the best book in the field. It's not perfect. Number one, it's not Lutheran, so that immediately makes it imperfect. But his theology is rather weak, and that makes it rather bad. But as a pastoral counselor, he must be at the forefront of those who are capable in the field. But his ability to assemble the material is absolutely amazing. It's that book is listed in our bibliography, so if you don't have it, you really should get it. It's the best available. It's written in 66, should be revised, but it's terrific. Kleindel puts it this way. Though often not so obvious and in some cases completely hidden, there is an existential spiritual dimension in every problem with which pastor and parishioner struggle in counseling. This is true because existential anxiety is inherent in every human experience. Then I have a quote from Kleindel, as he wrote in the Quarterly Journal of Studies on Alcohol. You know, Kleindel is best known for his book, Understanding and Counseling the Alcoholic. That is a positive gem. The best thing that I know of, in the English language anyway, on alcoholism. But this is what he writes, and this is a fantastic, it's kind of involved, but listen, if you go to sleep at the beginning, listen to the last part. Poke your neighbor if you see him dozing, but it's not that long. He says, anxiety in general is the response of the human organism to anything that is perceived as a threat to what one regards as essential to one's welfare or safety. Okay, we buy that. Pathological or neurotic anxiety arises when contradictory impulses, desires, or needs clamor simultaneously for expression or satisfaction. It is the result of inner conflict. It serves the function of keeping material that is unacceptable to the self-image repressed. In contrast, existential anxiety is non-pathological or normal anxiety. It arises from the very nature of human existence. Listen to this now, wake up. Man is the animal who knows he will die. He is trapped by his rootage in nature. He is subject to its forces of sickness, pain, and death. And he lacks what Big Daddy in Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof calls the pig's advantage. That is, the pig's advantage is his ignorance of his mortality. Man knows he must die. Of course, this is nothing new to you, but the most famous phrase of Carl Jung's Modern Minister to the Soul has to be brought in at this point, doesn't it? When he writes, among all my patients in the second half of life, that is to say over 35, there has not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. Interestingly, Jung, who was a pastor's son, as you probably know, not only said that once, but alludes to it again and again. And in his two lectures, his book entitled Two Lectures on Analytical Psychology, this is what he says, that therefore, I consider it wiser to recognize the idea of God consciously. Otherwise, something else becomes God. As a rule, something quite inappropriate and stupid. Viktor Frankl likewise sees the problem of man as basically spiritual. In his Man's Search for Meaning, he indicates as the major thesis of his logotherapy that man's will to meaning is the fundamental drive of human life. He quotes as almost as a proof text, the words of Nietzsche, who said at one time, he who has a why to live can bear almost any how. He who has a why can bear almost any how. It is this will to meaning which provides the framework of a fruitful life, he says. Hence, the therapist's aim is to assist his patient to find a sense of meaning satisfying to him. Do I have to expand on that for the Christian sales sort? Frankl also speaks of the existential vacuum which manifests itself in a sense of meaninglessness in life. He finds this, finds the genesis of this in boredom today, the state of boredom, and he expects that it's going to increase as leisure time is more available to more people. Okay, so we see that from various standpoints, the pastor is playing a vital role. The magnitude of the mental health problem, the magnitude of the spiritual problem of the day, the existential anxiety at every hand, and of course the fact that people are turning to us. Anyway, another question then is, in what sense can a minister be considered to be competent to counsel? First, one has to deal with the question of the growing discontent with psychiatry, or at least Freudian psychoanalytic theory. In his book, which you probably have all read, Bridging the Gap by Merton P. Stroman, you've certainly all gotten a copy of The Study of Generations, I'm sure. Well, Stroman was one of the key persons involved in that, wrote that little book, Bridging the Gap. If you haven't gotten it, you really should get it. Indicates one direction that the discontent has manifested itself. This is what he says. A quiet revolution in psychology began in 1952 when Eysenck, an English psychologist, reported on his reviews of the outcomes of psychotherapy. Eysenck concluded that people might just as well not bother with psychotherapy. Sugar pills were just as effective and much cheaper. And Stroman continues, his gadfly statements continued as a frantic note in the profession, and soon the psychological journals were carrying articles, pro and con. 12 years later, a review of the research studies came up with essentially the same conclusions as Eysenck's. Then Berylson and Steiner, in their book, Human Behavior and an Inventory of Scientific Findings, have the following to say. Psychotherapy has not yet been proved more effective than general medical counseling in treating neurosis or psychosis. In general, therapy works best with people who are young, well-born, well-educated, and not seriously sick. And as H.J. Eysenck himself put it very succinctly, listen to this one, this is a gem. You can see why the psychologists get mad. The success of the Freudian revolution seemed complete. Only one thing went wrong. The patients did not get better. Now, some attempts to discredit psychiatry have gone to rather unusual lengths, and I just want to throw this in as an aside. In 1973, David Rosenhan, I think an Irishman, I'm not sure, suspected that the techniques of diagnosis of mental health were somewhat faulty. So what he did, he involved 12 people, 11 people in addition to himself. No, I'm sorry, 6 people in addition to himself, in a kind of conspiracy. They had themselves admitted to 12 different state hospitals, 11 state hospitals and one private hospital. Now, obviously, some of them went to 2 hospitals, if there are only 7 of them. The 12 hospitals were found in 5 different states on the east and the west coasts. Each called the admission office for an appointment. The same complaint in the exact same words was used. I hear voices, unclean voices. I think they say empty, hollow thud. What do you think happened to them? Well, I guess you could guess, huh? They acted perfectly normal, with the exception of that one phrase. Each of them was admitted to the hospital. Only the private hospital evaluated the patient there, or the individual there, as a manic depressive. The others said that they were suffering from schizophrenia. Once in the hospital, they behaved in a perfectly normal fashion. They were never detected as pseudo-patients. The length of the hospitalization ranged from 7 to 52 days. In some cases, they had to have their wives plead for their release. Another study by Rosenhan grew out of a complaint of one of the hospitals involved. They said it wouldn't happen, it couldn't happen here. It just didn't happen here. So he simply told him, he says, within the next 3 months, you're going to have a pseudo-patient. The whole staff was alerted to this grave danger. Well, 193 patients were admitted to the hospital during this 3 month period. 41 of them were confidently judged by at least one staff member to be a pseudo-patient. 19 of them were judged by a staff member and a psychiatrist to be a pseudo-patient. Now, how many people do you think this nasty guy Rosenhan sent up there? None. Robert Harper, no comment. Robert Harper, though quite convinced that some temporary help is available to the person with a low ego strength through the techniques of psychotherapy, concludes in his book, Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy, which incidentally is on the suggested reading list, not in our list, but in Kleinbell's book. That's how I happened to find it originally. Concludes his whole book in this way. It seems quite evident that as the ever brighter light of science increasingly penetrates psychotherapy, all the systems of this makeshift institution will reveal more fiction and fact, more myth than science. He's very serious when he writes this. The day may not be too far distant with the advances of biochemistry, physiology, and biophysics, as well as psychology itself, that what we now call psychotherapy will relate to the scientific treatment and prevention of behavioral disorders as astrology now relates to astronomy. We have to take another look at psychotherapy. Certainly, it is in difficulty on pragmatic grounds. But then when one turns to a theoretical framework, one observes a multiplicity of problems. Hardly had Freud enunciated his laws of the Medes and Persians, but Adler and Jung deserted the ranks. Then the ranks of the neo-Freudians were filled by people like Karen Horney, Eric Frohm, Eric Erickson, Harry Stack Sullivan, and others. The learning theorists got to work, notably Dollard and Miller, Bandura and Walters. The field theorists, Kurt Goldstein, Abraham Maslow, and Carl Rogers got into the act. And so the beat went on and continues to the present. In terms of pastoral counseling, I'd like to suggest just five of these people being particularly important. First, Carl Rogers. Rogers, in his clinical, he's not a psychiatrist, as you probably know. He's a clinical psychologist. In his first position, following graduation, he worked at the Rochester Guidance Center. Here, he began to become very much affected by reading in the works of Otto Rank, who himself was a deviant from Freudian ideas. Ranke was appalled at the duration of these counseling sessions, sometimes going 2 and 3 years, with virtually no progress being made. He pressed for short-term counseling. He pressed also for doing something about the problem, not just simply this interminable archaeological dig into the past, but doing something with the present, you see. And obviously this made him rather an outcast in Freudian circles. And he also opted for something that'll sound very familiar to you, opted for a client-centered point of view. Carl Rogers grabbed that. Carl Rogers, I guess you know, studied at Union Seminary in New York for a year or two. Had a rather weak view of the doctrine of man, of course. But he began to develop a point of view which was quite at variance with what he had learned before. This authoritarian psychotherapeutic methodology of the orthodox practitioner did not appeal to Rogers at all. He saw this in his own practice. He discussed it with his colleagues at the Rochester Institute, and Ranke was haunting him. He began to experiment with this. He came up with this client-centered therapy. He felt that a diagnosis was of very little value at all. As a matter of fact, it may be a hindrance to the therapeutic process, lest the counselee begin to think of you as some kind of an expert, say, with all of the answers. So the major thrust of the process was to accept unconditionally the feelings of the client, to reflect, to attempt to understand those feelings, to aid the client in personality change through the unconditioned positive regard for and the empathetic understanding of the client by the therapist. And those are the words I'm sure you're all familiar with concerning Rogers. Now, Rogers is to be commended for the fact that he opened his methodology to the most careful scientific scrutiny. He made tape recordings of the sessions, movies of the actual sessions, and the like. I think this model of objectivity was sadly lacking prior to this, and it sets a challenge to all who follow him. As you, of course, realize, the Rogerian approach was taken over by Carol Wise, was furthered by Seward Hiltner, and became the approach of pastoral counseling through the 40s and 50s, and even to the 60s. A second individual, whom we might note, is O.H. Maurer, who burst upon the world of psychology in 1961 with his Crisis in Psychiatry and Religion. Now, this isn't the first time he appeared on the scene. Maurer is well known in psychological circles before that. He was honored with the presidency of the American Psychological Association because of his work in learning theory. But in this book, he challenged the total field of psychiatry. He said, categorically, it is a failure. And he made a gallant effort, and some feel a very successful effort, to refute the Freudianism, which was the basic underpinning of that system. One of the major contributions of this work is that Maurer took a firm stand against the medical model from which the concept of mental illness derives. He rejected the idea that the individual was sick, that this illness divorced him from any responsibility for his problem. Rather, he said, the individual is personally responsible. Maurer proposed that the patient should look within himself for the root cause of his difficulty. In place of the medical model, he proposed a moral model, which some of his followers have called integrity therapy. He says The individual is suffering from real guilt, not just guilt feelings, as Freud would say, real guilt. And the way he resolves it is by confessing it and then changing his life. His success has been a continuing embarrassment to the Freudians. Another approach, which is very much like Maurer's, which is based on Maurer's. As a matter of fact, William Glasser's book, Reality Therapy, has as Maurer wrote the preface to the book, or the introduction to the book. And Glasser, in Reality Therapy, begins his book by giving something of his own experience, something like that of Rogers. He, of course, is a psychiatrist. He's coming to the end of his studies, and he's confused by what he sees and the lack of results. So he talks to his teachers, and they say, well, you have to learn a lot on the field. Then you'll begin to appreciate what's being done. He's not satisfied by that. He speaks to Dr. G. L. Harrington, one of his last teachers. He goes into his office and lays this burden on his desk, as it were. And G.L. Harrington reaches up, extends his hand, he says, join the club. Now, what happened to Glasser then is that he began to work with G.L. Harrington. They developed a system which he calls reality therapy. Like Maurer, he rejects the medical model. Hence, when he's asked, what is really wrong? Why is a person seeking psychiatric help? The reply is, the person has not been meeting his needs. What are those needs, you say? He says, there are two in number. The need to love and to be loved. The need, secondly, to have a sense of worth, to be worthwhile to ourselves and to others. Two basic needs. Helping patients fulfill these two needs, then, is the basis of reality therapy. Responsibility, according to Glasser, is the ability to fulfill one's needs and to do so in a way that doesn't deprive others of the ability to fulfill their needs. In contrast to Freud, who would say that the problem is not irresponsibility because the person is ill, say, he would say, no! He's ill because he's irresponsible. One must confront him with responsibility. Glasser adds that he has to act in accordance with responsibility and reality. Reality, for Glasser, is a very difficult thing to pin down. But it seems to mean that one is acting realistic when he understands and acts upon the long-range results of his activity, of his... He understands the long-range consequences of those things which he does and thinks. Perhaps it's in some way related to what Sidney Harris meant when he said, a truly educated man is one who knows and properly appraises the consequences of his action. If you've not read Reality Therapy, you're in for one of the thrills of your life to see what happened at the Ventura School out in California, the most incorrigible girl delinquents. You will absolutely be astounded. And then when you see what G.L. Harrington did with the back ward men at a VA hospital who were in the back ward for, on the average of 15 years. He has reached the point now where every year there is a complete turnover in the totally hopeless, quote-unquote, ward. Then, after, at about the same time, as a matter of fact, that Maurer's bombshell hit the psychiatric community, Eric Byrne came onto the scene. And he introduced his new, or his neo-Freudian model to the world. This is known, as you recall, as transactional analysis, and particularly popularized by his bestseller Games People Play, and also by Thomas Harris's bestseller, I'm Okay, You're Okay. This new approach, though it's built upon Freudian understanding, seems to show little patience for the psychoanalytic techniques that are intrinsic to Freudianism. Harris will pay lip service to Freud, but one senses that there is a damning quality in this faint praise which he gives to Freudianism. He writes, for example, "I respect the devoted effort of the psychoanalytic theorists of the past. What I hope to demonstrate is a new way to state old ideas and a clear way to present new ones, not as inimical or deprecating assault on the work of the past, but rather as a means of meeting the undeniable evidence," get this now, "the undeniable evidence that the old methods do not seem to be working very well." The major departure in technique in TA is that it sees value to understanding, you know, what has gone on in the past, but it seeks to do something about it now, and seeks to understand the transactions which take place between those familiar, the parent, the adult, and the child, the PAC formula, which I trust you're all somewhat familiar with. Suffice it to say, and we must be hurrying on, we've only got about 20 minutes left, to say that though Freudian presuppositions are included, the therapeutic model bears no resemblance to this model, that Freudian model that I can ascertain. In a word, it's an approach which is tantamount to rejection of the old. Another system of counseling, the only avowedly Christian model with which we're dealing in this phase of our study, is that of J.E. Adams of Westminster Seminary, Philadelphia. Anybody read J. Adams' book, Competent to Counsel? Have one, huh? Oh, ahead of the game. Well, maybe you might learn something today. No, all of the others is just review. But Adams admits a pervading influence of Maurer and Glasser upon his thinking. But he attempts to construct a biblical model, quite distinct from those of Maurer and Glasser. He utterly rejects the Freudian model, and with it then the medical model, with its concomitant loss of sense of personal responsibility. "The counselee is not sick," Adams says, "but rather he's a person with unresolved personal problems." Adams puts it this way, in his inimitable fashion. Quote, "What is wrong with the mentally ill? Their problem is autogenic, it is in themselves. The fundamental bent of fallen human nature is away from God. Man is born in sin, goes astray from his mother's womb, speaking lies," Psalm 58:3, "and will therefore naturally," that is by nature, "attempt various sinful dodges in an attempt to avoid facing up to his sin. He will fall into varying styles of sin according to the short-term successes or failures of the particular sinful responses which he makes to life's problems. Apart from organically generated difficulties, the mentally ill are really people with unresolved personal problems. There is a mounting conviction that much bizarre behavior must be interpreted as a camouflage intended to divert attention from one's otherwise deviant behavior." Now, Adam's therapeutic technique is primarily confrontational. He calls his approach nouthetic counseling, from the Greek word noutheteo. In essence, it is a personal conference and a discussion directed toward bringing about change in the direction of greater conformity to biblical principles and biblical practices. And he says any biblically legitimate verbal means may be employed to affect this reorientation of lifestyle. His approach is basically behavioristic. He says that the aim of nouthetic counseling is love from a pure heart. But when you ask him, what is love? He simply says that it is the fulfillment of God's commandments. We'll hear more about Adam shortly, if our time holds out. Now, these modern approaches to psychotherapy certainly indicate to us that we should take a second look at the old orthodoxy. This is not to say that it's all wrong. I personally don't think it is all wrong at all. But we have to take some second looks at it. It is in trouble. Who then is competent to counsel? Maurer poses a question which all of us should deal with. He says, has evangelical religion sold its birthright for a mess of psychological pottage? At this point in my thinking, I really can't reject utterly the insights that psychology has provided for us. I think that there are gains which are absolutely immense in terms of my own understanding of myself as well as others. But it's also difficult for me to deny the fact that the pastor should never question his being a person in the forefront of those who are needed in the resolution of the massive mental health problem that's confronting our nation today. I don't think we have to hold our hats in our hands and wonder whether we are in any sense properly the person to do counseling. Certainly, pastoral counseling. Adams, of course, would reject me out of hand. He would call me an eclectic, which I am. And his thesis follows. This is what he says. Preeminently, he says, a nouthetic counselor must be conversant with the scriptures. Who can argue with that? This is one reason why properly equipped ministers may make excellent counselors. Who can disagree with that? A good seminary education rather than a medical school degree or degree in clinical psychology is the most fitting background for a counselor. Some might have difficulty with that. But Adams doesn't stand alone. Glasser, whose reality therapy just came out in a paperback, incidentally, used to cost a nominal egg, is only about $1.95 now. Sell all and go out and buy it if you haven't purchased it and read it. But in the introduction introductory note to the paperback edition, which came out in 75, just early this year, this is what he said. We have established the Institute for Reality Therapy in Los Angeles, where we give extensive training in the use of these ideas, reality therapy, to anyone who works with people. We are more interested in need than we are in formal credentials, because we recognize that most of the gut-level mental health work in this country is done by people without extensive training, such as parents, probation officers, teachers, school administrators, ministers, drug rehabilitation counselors, and psychiatric technicians, to cite some of the people who have studied with us. Kleinbell, who has much more of a psychological orientation, would not disagree with that, but rather would indicate to us, and here I'm going to skip over some materials that I have here, would indicate that the minister should not be reluctant even to handle depth counseling. By that I mean more extensive counseling periods. It might extend to a year or even 2 years. And even the Rogerian Sud Hiltner will allow for this. It's interesting to notice that the report of the Joint Commission of Mental Health presented to Congress just a few years ago indicated that there are far too few highly trained persons, such as psychologists and psychiatrists, social workers and the like, to accomplish the task that's confronting the needs in our nation regarding mental health. This is what the report concludes. It says a host of persons untrained or partially trained in the mental health principles and practices are needed to get the task accomplished. Certainly no minister could possibly exempt himself from that, the lowest category, if not, as many people would put us, in virtually, if not the highest category of all. Okay, then our last, effective pastoral counseling. The key in all the literature, one characteristic of a successful counselor stands out supreme, namely a loving and empathetic personality. In the book already referred to by Merton P. Stroman, Bridging the Gap, in which he indicates, remember that Isaac stated that there's little value to psychotherapy, he continues this way. He says, quote, but a puzzle remained. Through therapeutic counseling, some people were actually finding a sense of personal reality, were giving evidence of having been helped. What factors could account for their being helped? More studies were conducted. And these findings began to surface. It is not technique, but the human qualities of warmth, empathy, and genuineness that account for effective therapy. Well, now, what if these qualities were missing in the therapist? Truax at the University of Wisconsin showed that when several highly trained therapists lacked these qualities, the condition of their extremely alienated patients deteriorated. But when other therapists, also highly trained, rank well in the qualities of warmth, empathy, and genuineness, their counselees made notable advances. The evidence was quite clear. The important factor in helping another person is a sense of trust, an identity which is not having a technique or being an expert, but a being rather than a doing. And I'm bold to suggest that one of the most important concepts you can grasp here today is this, that what you are is more important than your technique or what you say in a counseling situation. Now, that is not to say that you should not have technique, and we'll be talking about that. Not that you should not say the right things, but what you are is more important than the two. And this, of course, is law and gospel. It places the burden of being more than we can be. And thus it condemns us. But it thrusts us completely upon the power of the means of grace by which alone we can be transformed by God's Spirit into effective counselors. That's what we were hearing about yesterday and today in chapel. Thank God for those wonderful addresses. The interesting thing is that people have been saying this for years. Alfred Adler, in his Understanding Human Nature, one of the classics, says that empathy is one of the creative functions in personality. Rollo May, in his Art of Counseling, written 1939, I believe it is, has this to say, that empathy is the key to the counseling process. He sees it as the key to influence both negatively and positively in the relationship between counselor and counselee. Now, Carl Rogers' client-centered therapy likewise comes to grips with the importance of characteristics of the therapist. In his On Becoming a Person, he indicates three major factors. First of all, he says, it has been found that personal change is facilitated when the psychotherapist is what he is. When in the relationship with his client, he is genuine and without front or facade, openly being the feelings and attitudes which at the moment are flowing in him. And thus, as you know, he has coined the term congruence to describe what he's talking about. Congruence is being genuine, being what you are, not putting on your counseling, pastoral counseling, therapeutic technique approach or personality, say, but being just you, being the real you. This causes growth, he says. Secondly, when the therapist is experiencing a warm, positive, and acceptant attitude toward what is in the client, this
facilitates change. Warm, positive, acceptant attitude toward what is in the client. This facilitates change. Third condition, he says, we may call, and I'm quoting Rogers, we may call empathetic understanding when the therapist is sensing the feelings and personal meanings which the client is experiencing in each moment, when he can perceive these from inside, sort of like what Buber talks about, feeling from the other side type of thing, where you put your hand on someone else's hand and you try to feel what he's feeling as you touch his hand. Say. When you experience this type of empathy with the individual, then the third condition is fulfilled. So it's evident that it's more than just bouncing back some feelings, but it's genuineness. It's empathy. It's personal regard. Turning from the client-centered therapy to a more directive therapy, we've got 5 minutes, one might expect that our friend Glasser would be somewhat different, because his certainly is much more directive. But he starts out with the absolute necessity of what he calls involvement between the client and the counselor. He says, unless this is present, there will be no growth in the individual. And incidentally, Glasser corrects some of the ideas that we've had about, that have grown out of Rogers. Glasser says it's not some weak, sentimental, loving, old grandfatherly type that pats you on the back. It's a strong person. A powerful person, a person who can stand up to the individual and say, ultimately, you were wrong. You are irresponsible, you see. But it's only when you will become involved with that individual that this can happen. Kleinbell, in the last chapter of his book, says the key to the counseling, to growth as a counselor, is the pastor's personality. Now, if a warm and loving, empathetic personality is a prime requisite to effective counseling, it hardly seems necessary to emphasize that we have to rush back to the grace of God in order to receive this thing. We simply can't work it up ourselves. Remember, St. Paul says, take heed unto thyself and to the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this thou shalt both save thyself and those that hear thee. And again, he says, but we all with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed, that is transfigured into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. This is his work, it's not ours. He does the transfiguring, to him then is the glory. I'd like to urge each of you to think also of the need to develop your own differential methodology. It is decidedly my opinion that, at this stage at least, that I can't tell you what to do in this regard. You have to do your own searching. You have to do your own study. You have to check your own strengths and weaknesses and develop your own differential methodology. I think a reductionist point of view has to be wrong. There is no one answer to this problem. I can't use the same methodology when someone is bereaved as when someone is in a marriage counseling situation. I can't use the same methodology with a young person as I can with an aged person. There has to be a different point of view. Eternity magazine had an article back in January. It was entitled Pastoral Counseling, Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo. And that's the way one feels when he tries to reduce this to one common denominator, and Adams and all of the rest, I think, have something to offer us. A couple of words. 2 minutes, I think. 3 minutes. A couple of words. Check the theology of these people. You are a theologian. Don't say, well, we leave that to the CTCR. No way. You are the theologian on the field. Indeed. It's a horrible thought, but that's absolutely true. We are the theologians on the field. We've got to develop our own understanding of the theological presuppositions of these positions, and we have to immediately, I suggest, reject some of Rogers, because his view of man is simply not a biblical view. We have to understand that T.A. will simply say man is okay without the redemptive work of Jesus Christ. That's wrong, obviously. Glasser talks about responsibility, but what is his criterion for responsibility? Does he use the law at all? No, he doesn't. And one has to realize this. Adams is so Calvinistic that he says that we can't even tell our counselee that Christ Jesus died for him. But having done this, then we develop our own methodology. And it is, as I suggest, not an easy task. It takes study. It takes a lot of hard work. It takes introspection. It takes knowing ourselves. It takes knowing the data. It takes reading. It may take a quarter of clinical pastoral education. It may take going to Glasser's Institute. It may take some in-depth study of TA. It may take going over to one of Adams's counseling technique centers. It may take all of this and more, but we shouldn't let it slip away, slip through our hands without developing those techniques which for us will be effective. One last word. When I was a student in Boston many, many years ago, I often walked by Trinity Church, and not realizing that I would one day write a doctoral dissertation on Phillips Brooks, I'd look up at his statue outside the church in the courtyard. And one of the things that struck me was this man with his right arm outstretched, one of the most eloquent men who has ever preached in the United States, has standing behind him a statue, a figure of Jesus Christ, with Jesus' right hand on his left shoulder. I'd like to remind you as you go back to your parishes that Jesus Christ is likewise with you as you preach. It is his word you preach. He gives it the power. He is the one that speaks to people through you. I'd like also to remind you that every time a person comes into your study, or every time you are in a home and a problem is poured out, that Jesus Christ is also there. And he has his hand on your shoulder. And he, by his grace and by his love and his power, alone can make you, in the final analysis, an effective counselor.